because it's got 2 million tears in the social fabric. So we really hope that folks will kind of take the opportunity to look at what this crisis is doing to their communities and recognize that there's a better way. Like, rather than locking people up behind bars because they're poor, because they have substance use issues, because they have mental health challenges, try to solve those underlying problems. Like, they're not solved by steel and concrete. They're solved by treatment and opportunity.
That was my conversation with Mike Wessler, Communications Director at the Prison Policy Initiative. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local public media and community radio stations. Become members. Become volunteers. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just a soul's intentions.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO's fall membership drive is just around the corner. Help us kick off our KBOO Out Loud Drive on August 20th for National Radio Day, where we'll bring you more of our independently made content, KBOO stories, and KBOO testimonials all day long.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. You know, over the past few months, we've been having a number of conversations that center around the concept of love. And there's so many variations, so many angles to look at when we talk about it. I think the last time we had a good conversation with scholar Robin G. Kelly, who came on and was talking about love. And, you know, we've talked about love as defined by Dr. Martin Luther King, agape love. And I think this concept has really taken hold as we embark on new frontiers or new challenges for younger generations around pushing back on fascism. What do movements look like? How do we take care of one another? And self-care and love have become dominant words that are used around conversation. Joy is also included in that. Well, here's somebody this afternoon who's written a book, and it's a good one. It is called In Pursuit of Revolutionary Love, Precarity, Power, Community. And it is by author Joy James, who has a number of books. She has authored the book Transcending the Talented Tenth, Black Leaders and American Intellectuals, Shadow Boxing, Imprisoned Intellectuals, The New Abolitionists, Resisting State Violence, and the Angela Y. Davis Reader. Did we leave anything out? Do you have another 14 books we should be?
Yeah, I just like bore your audience. He's like, oh, he's doing a roll call. It's lasting too long. But yeah, I would say editing, one of the greatest challenges was to edit on the writings of people who were mostly overlooked at the time, like some 10, 20 years ago, people who were politicized, who were incarcerated, who were framed by COINTELPRO, FBI. And so imprisoned intellectuals, the new abolitionists, warfare in the American homeland. Mm-hmm. Those are the three texts that I really had to focus, because it wasn't just an academic project. It was, you know, a recognition of their devotion to community. So I see them as being revolutionary lovers. And maybe that was something in my mind before I even, you know, start to use that phrase.
Right. You said that you weren't really going to write this book, right? It was kind of like things were happening, and it was almost like, let me hold my coffee moment. You know, I have something to say. You know, if I'm correct, it kind of was spawned with seeing the outpouring of protest around George Floyd and all those movements that kind of, you know, crystallized some of this.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I wasn't looking for this book, right? I had other projects I was working on. And actually, it's a collective book, mm-hmm. a small press based in the UK and London and Brussels reached out to me, a small feminist press, and they were like, we'd like to do a book. And they read Shadowboxing and wanted to do something about feminism. And I was like, well, we've just gone through, you know, the COVID lockdown, disproportional dying, like for our people, working class people, poor, undocumented people. I understand the billionaires just made more money. I don't even know how that works.
Yeah.
But we were having a lot of conversations in podcasts because we couldn't go out or were afraid to go out. And we're fortunate enough to have internet and to have homes. So these conversations with diverse parties about, I'd say, maybe 10 different podcast formats. I was trying to get all their names on the back cover or the front cover of the book, and the publisher said that doesn't work. It's too many names. But it's a collective book, and I think it shines, or at least Mumia Abu-Jamal, who did the afterword, he says it shines when you get past the first part, essays where I do my political analyses of the U.S. and democracy as a Trojan horse for us. And when you get to the last two parts, precarity, power, and community. Yes, so power and community sections. Those are when they're all conversations, and we're trying to work out what we need to do to care for each other, but also resist fascism and white supremacist poverty and exploitation and misogyny.
Right. So this is kind of like it's you, but it's a number of other people mm-hmm. Contributing to the conversation. And I'm, you know, that seems to be probably when we have these type of books, and especially with somebody of your background, you pull no punches, you're radical in thought, revolutionary, you know, underscores where you're coming from. We kind of need to have the team on point. Would you not agree to really bring in and hone in on some of these complex ideas? Because hopefully this stands the test of time and it becomes something that we can look back at and really glean a lot of jewels and gems.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I don't believe there are people who have incredible skills, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the names that we know that are out there. I mean, some names we know just because they're popularized and it's cultural. But when we are facing predatory structures, we are a we. It's not as isolated individual, great mind thinker. I mean, Malcolm had people around them. Fannie Lou Hamer had people around them. King had people around them, right? Ella Baker had people around them. Everybody who struggles for freedom and honor is thinking and working collectively. And so hopefully this book tries to express that. I want to read one short paragraph from the afterword, because yesterday was Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday. Right? And there was a great celebration, you know, on Black Power Media, where Mumia actually, excuse me, called in. So this is Mumia's afterword of a segment from it. I can't define revolutionary love, but here's what Mumia says. Revolutionary love is umpth degree love, or love beyond measure. It is anything love. It is love without reckoning. It is love that dares all things beyond which others may find the spirit force to survive, to live, to fight another day. Such love is also fighting itself for the sake of ensuring that others may live. So all the care that you were talking about earlier, those are real too, but it's, I put the revolutionary in front of it because it's not just about self-care and it's not just about your personal family or your personal crew. It's really it's a greater love in which we hope that we can also have time to care for ourselves. But people who have children know that you sacrifice a lot. It's not just your money and time, but the care that you give to yourself, you share with others. And then as your parents age, you share with them, right? So it's always collective and communal. But because we are in a structure that over centuries has accumulated through our suffering and our deaths, even when they monetize payouts once, you know, police kill us, that's not a resurrection, you know, as we say in the book, it's just like, it's a check.
Right.
So we still have to reinvent ourselves under duress and stress. And the only way I think we could do it if we abided by the fact that we love each other to the best of our capacity. And in that way, we also love ourselves.
That's the voice of Joy James, professor of at Williams College, the author of the book In Pursuit of Revolutionary Love, Precarity, Power, and Community. Before we dwell into the book, and I'm glad that you mentioned the afterword by Momia, that's a powerful aspect to the book as he gives his breakdown of things. I was thinking as you were talking, it seems like it's real important that we have a particular orientation in our heads, at least, because that will, you know, that will kind of give a particular vibration. For example, when you talked about self-care, right? Self-care could be, I'm just, you know, I don't care what you all are doing. I got to take care of myself. And that could be very selfish and even disruptively selfish if, you know, you are depending upon me to do something. But if self-care is viewed from the perspective that I gleaned from parts of the book and what you're saying, look, I have to take care of myself because I have to take care of my parents when they get older, or I have to take care of myself because I have to have my A game, you know, in leadership position and people are depending upon me. I have to take care of myself if I'm going to be a contributor to this book. You know, I have to have a clear mindset. And those they're the same gestures, but they're a world of difference depending on what my orientation is. And so, it seems like in the book you're trying to really get us to be oriented in a particular philosophy, maybe, if that's the right word, or understanding. So even though we may have the same gestures as the guy up the street, it's very different. In other words, if you as a revolutionary have $1 million versus me, you know, a devout, you know, unapologetic capitalist, you know, exploitative capitalist has $1 million, it's a world of difference in terms of what we're going to do with that money, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's a couple of things when you're thinking, a lot of ideas were going through my brain. Like, one, there's a concept, quantum entanglement, that we're, you know, we all come from what I say, cosmic soup, and we all go back into it, right? And so for some people, they look through that through religion, right? Other people look through that through the lens of spirituality. And spirituality and religions are not the same, but they're aligned in different ways, right? We also know religions can be used to take people into war and also enslave people.
Right.
I don't think, when I think of quantum entanglement, how we're entangled with each other, I don't think there's any way that we have an identity as an isolate. We came out of family. It may not always be the healthiest family or the family with all the resources, but even that we learn speech, that we understand emotional registers, that we can connect with people, that means we're around people and we're being socialized by them. And sometimes they love us and sometimes they don't. But for us to love ourselves, we would have to be connected. To be an isolate, I mean, this is what we know, right, from prisons. You know, this is why Obama, he didn't do much about, you know, incarceration, mass incarceration, nothing about political incarceration. But when you get to Rikers and you think about the teens who are put into lockdown or isolation, right? after so many days, the medical establishment has already told us their brains, their minds start to disaggregate. They start to fall apart. They become psychotic. They're more likely to commit suicide. And so now in New York City, they're bringing back these isolation units, right? Solitary confinement, which you, if you think about people that we've known in the past, George Jackson was in for years, different people in for years. Some people survive, some people, their minds are never the same. They're not whole again.
So wait, in spite of this information, they're bringing back the isolation units?
Yeah, I mean, they're bringing back stop and frisk. And this is the thing, we talk in the book about Black faces in high places. I'm like, Trojan horse. We should just have like a flag that goes up. Trojan horse, like, this is looks like a war and something's going to come out of that gift. It's not really a gift, right? It's going to be some kind of assault. So, yeah, I mean, we have a Black mayor, Eric Adams, who's former NYPD. And we have Keechan Sewell, the first Black woman commissioner. And people want to celebrate these first Black. I mean, yeah, but I'm old enough to remember when y'all decided that it was important to have Clarence Thomas replace Thurgood Marshall because you needed a Black face. And so you got the most reactionary Supreme Court justice because white supremacist Republicans wanted to play a shell game with you.
Right?
We'll give you somebody Black and you're just going to like go support them. And in the, again, how we love each other. I'm going to say for this, stay here for a moment. Both Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas were working in the Reagan administration, probably to eviscerate workers' rights, the rights of people who were claiming racial discrimination, sexism, and homophobia or transphobia. Back in the day, transphobia wasn't a big issue like with the right as it is now. But Anita Hill's allegations were credible. And so the need to have a Black face made us overlook other kinds of vulnerabilities and abuse, even though she's a Republican, right? And she's working for Reagan and she's not doing progressive things. So now she's more liberal. So I guess this is a long way of me saying, if we want to love ourselves, we would have to abide by certain principles of not harming other people by becoming like Judge Clemens, who denied Mumia an evidentiary hearing after throwing out that story to the public through white Catholics. My grandfather was lynched. I understand the suffering of Black people. I'm one of y'all. And then it was like, well, you know, white cops don't want you out. Essentially, this is the way I read it. I can pervert the law and make sure that you stay inside for the rest of your life, even though there was no credibility to that prosecution.
Right.
So we would have to call ourselves into accountability. And that would include people, I call them, you know, movement millionaires, who collected millions of dollars. And it wasn't just individuals, it was corporations were giving out money to universities to do, I mean, I call it George Floyd blood money. Like it just flooded all these sectors, but it didn't go to radical people. It didn't go to working class people. It didn't go to poor people. It went back into, you know, the structure. So revolutionary love would call everyone to accountable, including myself, as I critique other people, right?
Right. You know, it's interesting that accountability that you speak about, Professor James, Joy James is our guest. Revolutionary love versus the cult of celebrity. You know, that seems to be a theme that I picked up on. Let's talk about that. How are you defining that? Or can you define it? Because sometimes those lines get to be blurred. And on the other side, in the need to kind of be perfect, like I'm going to be a revolutionary, I then start to look for things to critique you that really have nothing to do with anything. So you have a Black shirt on and I might be, well, you know, the sister had a Black shirt on, you know, Black is a negative color, you know, did you get your shirt from the Gap? And all of a sudden that overlooks all the good work you did because I was able to find a critique about your outfit. You know what I mean? So we often get caught up in that on the other side and say, I'm just being critical. I wonder if that's really about love or just trying to check a box off. if that's making sense.
No, it makes total sense. And it's the first time anybody's kind of posted it. It's a really complex query, right? Mm-hmm. I was thinking that song is a thin line between love and hate. There's a lot there what you said. I mean, one thing I want to just reference back to Clarence Thomas, he also used the legal lynching.
Yeah.
High-tech legal lynching, right? So again, people can use Black suffering, the history, the contemporary moment to leverage themselves in the public limelight, like I'm the spokesperson or I've felt that pain too. And I think that's duplicitous unless you were actually working for the people. So your question of like, how do you distinguish a revolutionary from a celebrity? And is this nitpicking or are we being distracted with just negative rhetoric, you know, and bashing people? I mean, that's totally legit. I can think there's a couple of things though that come to mind. You know, as we talked earlier before we started the conversation, you know, a beloved transition.
Harry Belafonte.
Yeah, at the age 96. Now he was a celebrity, but he was faithful. He was faithful to the struggle. I have no critique. Everybody's human. You know, you could critique King for stuff, Malcolm for stuff, whatever. But the people who were devoted, and he was able to live long enough. You know, Malcolm and, you know, Martin, you know, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz and Reverend King, they are assassinated. So they're stolen from us. They become ancestors, but they're stolen from us. Belafonte is an ancestor who had longevity and also could work in both worlds, but he never betrayed or used Black suffering as a shield or a promotion of his virtue. He wasn't virtue signaling. Like here I was this march, or I did this, or I got caught up in this, et cetera, et cetera. He was faithful, like 70 years span, more than 70 years span of devotion. That is revolutionary love. Right, but that is rare if you to get wealth and celebrity, because the state doesn't finance revolutionaries or rebellions. So I don't call myself a revolutionary because I have this job,
right,
and like they pay me, I get health insurance, and I know I comply, so I keep the job. So there's certain things I won't or can't do, but I support people who.
But that's also being strategic. And being smart in the act of war. If you are undercover, if you're Josephine Baker spying for the French or Harriet Tubman spying during the Civil War, then you don't walk around and go, you know, I'm a spy. You play the game and you do what needs to be done. You extract from, you know, the situation at hand. And, you know, and as an act of love, you're supposed to comply and sacrifice. It is a sacrifice if you are biting your tongue in certain moments, because your position in a war can be very advantageous, that you are a professor that we may need to rely upon strategically to say, do you have any credibility? Yeah, we have Professor Joy James here, the professor at William College. You know, I mean, those things make a difference in wartime situations. If we know, like, I know how she gets down, but she's not supposed to come up there and say the chancellor, the provost stinks, and, you know, and if she had a shotgun, she would blow everybody's head off. You're not, that's not your job. That's not your job.
Let me be clear. I definitely did not say that. Okay.
But you're not supposed to at all.
Yeah.
At all. But a critique would be, well, why didn't she call out the provost? If she was really about it, she should have done that. You see what I'm saying? Versus, you know, well, what about her other works that we're able to glean gems from?
I hear what you're saying, but this is why I don't make the claim of revolutionary. Also, because I like have visited some of them inside, right? And I had anthologized. So when you start these conversations with people, and they're not conversations of extraction, I'm not trying to like be the authority or expert on anything for, you know, academic chops, right? Or medals, right? There's a level of humility that comes with love. I mean, when you recognize it in other people, and too, like as humans, we can be a pain in the neck. We can be arrogant. We can be narcissistic. We can be self-absorbed, all those things. None of us are perfect. And we all make mistakes. I make mistakes too. But I think there's a difference between people who are leveraged by liberals, right? Mm-hmm. As expressions of our desire to be free, when liberals won't leverage the people who actually fought for us to be free. They disappear them in prisons, or when they come out, you know, people have to find jobs or housing. They're elderly. Like, again, they're not going to be like Harry Belafonte. They're not going to have those resources. So I have said more than once on a platform, if we've collected, whoever the we is, all this money following George Floyd and other deaths before and the deaths after and the deaths to come, you know, through police violence, state murder, then what would happen if we pulled our resources and created like hospice zones out of some of those multiple houses? Like for me personally, like two could be the max. Right. Because his money, I mean, Harry Belafonte made his money through Hollywood. That was legit. Here's a contract my agent signed on. It's like people didn't like have to have mass protests for him to get money. He had skills as an artist. That was his money that then he put into the movement. I'm talking about something different. When the state and corporations start flooding money in to quell rebellions and resistance to state violence, that is the people's money because they generated that money with their protest. Right. But the money doesn't go back to the base. And we don't even have an apparatus where people could even poll non-elites about what do you think we should be doing with that money? Or are their nonprofits unionized? I mean, I don't have the answers, but like all these questions go through my mind. And I'm like, this feels a little unstable here as a foundation for us to connect in love for revolutionary relief of predatory violence.
It seems like that's almost something to be expected, you know, which means that grassroots or revolutionary organizations will have to find other ways to raise money. It may be, you know, taking your talent and singing songs, as Harry Belafonte once said, you know, sing those songs and get that money and then use it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, make the people happy. You know, he said, I can make a ton of money selling, you know, singing folk songs. You mm-hmm. know, like it wasn't the hippest thing, but it sure packed houses and he was able to, you know, fund a lot of folks. We do know that people with money will, you know, who have more nefarious agendas are going to use that money to silence either people who they feel have potential or give that money so that they could say they did it. You know, so, you know, here's $100,000 out of the $12 billion that I have. We gave it to Clarence Thomas and Candace Owens. Y'all should be happy. These are two up and coming black folks, you know, and we gave it to the sports guy as well, you know, Jason Whitlock. So we gave our money and the optics look good, you know, if you don't have a principle, but it's superficial, yes. But it's to be expected. And, you know, and you're also giving money to, you know, sometimes to people who you've already identified as ones who will comply to your advantage. If you give me the money, then I ain't gonna get on the air and say anything about you. You give them the money, they're not gonna protest. And in fact, they'll stand up against the protest. And
well, that's why it's perfect. Like you have a black opposition to a black revolutionary lover. I mean, because if it was a white person, you would just say, well, that's some other white supremacist that had some free time or they're getting paid by the hour. But when a black person pops up, because it's superficial, like we said, right? Right. There's no political analysis. And you're like, oh, it's black and I wrote them a check. Well, the same people who are writing checks to black people also write checks to the FOP, to the Fraternal Order of Police. I mean, and they give the police more money and for longer periods of time. So this becomes our discernment, our need to have discernment about who we are, that we're fragmented, that we're betrayed on a regular basis, that they're compradors, which are agents who work for the state. And then there are allies, who support. And I right. see myself as an ally to revolutionaries.
Right.
Because I'm not on the front line.
Right. And you can be a willing or unknowing comprador.
I don't know anymore because, yeah, well, maybe I do because I've said in the past, and I say it a bit in the book. So I grew up like on military bases with a military officer. And also I was in ROTC. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm sure during those early years, I was loyal, socialized to be loyal to the state, even though it's an imperial project that's destabilizing the so-called third world, and it's been doing it since World War II. A lot of people have been murdered through U.S. foreign policy. And so my dad was in Nam, right? And so I remember the numbers, or at least the numbers, hopefully I remember correctly, 55,000 U.S. casualties, deaths, 2 to 3 million Vietnamese deaths. But I also know my dad didn't get fragged. Like Colin Powell was afraid of being fragged, which is right. when you pull the pin from the grenade and you throw it back to the officer corps. My dad was not, because he understood, just as you said, maybe, he understood that he was a, quote, comprador or working for the state, because even with a college degree, he only could get a job, you know, washing dishes, because in the segregated South. So he goes into the military. And a lot of our people go into the military or into the police to find like a middle class, something kind of job. But he understood that he was being played and used, and he understood the nature of imperial warfare. Now, I believe that accelerated his death in his 1950, you know, when he's in his 50s, sorry. But he understood the contradiction. So I don't think we're stupid people. I think right. we're compromised, and we're caught between a rock and a hard place. Some people are just, you know, have a voracious appetite for being famous and for being rich. Those are people who tend not to be revolutionary lovers.
Okay. But if I'm going to dwell into the book a little bit. You mm-hmm. have the book. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with author Professor Joy James, the author of many books. But we are talking about her latest one, which is In Pursuit of Revolutionary Love, Precarity, Power, and Community. You start off by talking about precarity and activism. I had to look up precarity because I was like, that's a word I don't know. So let's jump off with that. I mean, I know it now, but I'll let you explain to the audience. And what were you trying to, how were you trying to orient us in this first segment of the book, which is like 6 or 7 chapters?
Right. I think it reflects the conversation that you and I are having now. Like, we have to understand this democracy and its violence, not just as we personally see it or in the ways in which its anti-blackness just makes lynchings, however you want to define them, but blood in the street, dead bodies, 2014, Eric Garner is followed by Michael Brown, and Michael Brown's death is followed by Tamir Rice, right? So the precarity is this continuous risk. This is why we tell our kids to be polite to cops, right? This is why we school them. We repress them, actually. We're telling them they can't be free. But we tell them that so that they have some longevity within a zone of entrapment called democracy. Mm-hmm. So the first chapters, right, in the section, like chapter one is revolutionary love, resist democracy. And that may seem like weird to people. I thought we want democracy. Yeah, but if you think about, let's just talk about the 13th Amendment, which we talk about in this book. This is what I call is the primary Trojan horse. That's the Emancipation Amendment. Like, and as Du Bois points out, some, you know, 190 to 200,000 of us fought in the Civil War, which is why the North won, right? And Lincoln didn't want us to fight at first because it's like, oh, free Black people who can protect themselves, that's like going to be problematic for everybody. Right. But then eventually we have to fight for the North to prevail. But then the 13th Amendment says that if you've been duly convicted of crime, involuntary servitude or slavery is legal in the United States. So they never abolished slavery. And then disproportionately, it's us. And after the Civil War, decades after, when you have the convict prison lease system, this is what I talk about in the book in these early essays, just setting up the history of who we are. we were worked to death because we were no longer private property. We were jointly owned by the state that arrested us and put us in jail. And then we worked for these corporations, including the ones from the North, coming down to exploit and rebuild the South. So revolutionary love would have to resist a democracy that continuously preys upon Black people and Indigenous people, poor people. The next chapter, Sorrow, Tears, and Blood, disavows the Talented Tenth. So I did the Talented Tenth book decades ago. There's a photo in there of Angela Davis with Nelson Mandela and Charlene Mitchell, who is the Black communist leader who mentored Davis into the Communist Party. And Charlene Mitchell also mentored me for a while when I was living in New York, and she transitioned last December. So it's how this Talented Tenth is not even a concept that came from Black people. Du Bois popularized it in The Souls of Black Folk, right, in 1903, but it came from white philanthropists and missionaries. So Spelman College is named after Laura Spelman, who's a Rockefeller, and Morehouse is named after Henry Morehouse, right, who's a white Christian philanthropist. And then Howard is named after a white general, I believe, who in the Civil War, who fought for the North, but then later—
I think many people think that these folks are all Black who—
No, they're all white elites, and their relationship to Blacks was very paternal. So what they wanted with the HBCUs is for Black people to stay in the South and to be regulated into a good, quote, workforce. They didn't want Black people to have autonomy into rebellion, because once they withdrew the Northern troops in the Rutherford Hayes Agreement, right, with the Confederacy to get a particular person elected president, that's when the KKK emerged. So you didn't want Black people to say, well, if this is another war, we still have all our weaponry from the last war, and so we'll just keep doing this till we're free. But it's like, no, here are your colleges, here are your elites, train you to be docile. Everything we say about the good Negro or Negress is shaped in the academy.
Was that the first flooding of resources to the community to quell rebellion?
That's a brilliant way to look at it. I'll tell you how I even got that book done. It was Charlene Mitchell, right, who told me— I met her in California because I had a postdoc with Davis. And no, I met her in New York first. She lived in Harlem. Then, you know, she'd go to California. And she was the one of the key persons who got Davis acquitted in terms of organizing that defense committee. By the way, Davis's co-defendant, Rushel McGee, is 84, still in prison. People need to write to him, check that things out, support him getting a release, right? Because he was acquitted, too, of all Marin County charges, just as Davis was. But it was Mitchell who told me to go to the Schomburg Library in Harlem and research everything that Du Bois wrote in terms of his memoirs. And that's where I saw the contradictions. Du Bois, actually, in the founding of the NAACP, he and, I believe, Mary Church Terrell isolated Ida B. Wells, who was the anti-lynching crusader,
right,
who risked her life, said, I have a pistol in my handbag, I will sell my life dearly. They put a bounty on her head. They said they were going to castrate her because first they thought she was a man when she wrote these editorials about lynching. But they blocked her from the NAACP. They forced her out. So yes, when the money floods in from Mary White Ovington, the white philanthropist who is paying for that meeting in Niagara Falls to start the NAACP, when the money comes in from white philanthropists who are building our HBCUs, those institutions are supposed to be aligned to the state and to nonprofit corporations. They don't meet with poor working class Black people and ask, what should we do? They meet with these boards and they say, what's the plan? So this is our history. There are always these circles of entrapment. And I think our capacity to love, with an analysis of what revolutionary possibilities exist, that allows us to get out of the Minotaur's maze. That allows us to get out of the cage. That allows us to stand in some autonomy to think more clearly.
Right. I think in one of those chapters you talk about force in opposition to enslavement is not violence. Yeah. And I didn't read it this way, but when I read it at first, I read it as force in opposition to enslavement is not violence, it's love. would I be correct in making that leap? Okay.
I think
because what you're describing, you know, or what I thought about as I was reading that was, well, part of flooding the community with resources and you know, helping people get to a next economic level or even social level is to redefine what love is ultimately about. So love for Black people is to turn the other cheek and to be forgiving, you know, and to, you know, to have kind of like an emotional love, you know, like you came and shot my grandparents at the grocery store and I forgive you.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know? And to me, you know, I don't know if that's love. And, you know, now I'm somebody who goes to church every Sunday, you mm-hmm. know, but I'm also, you know, like, sometimes love is stamping at, you know, the cockroach in my house, the whole brood has got to go. All of them, because if I leave one here, you'll infest the food. It's out of love for making sure we don't get infected. The whole, you know, and so this thing of, you know, I'm not a turn the other cheek.
Well, but see, it's so complicated, right? Because also I was in seminary. So, but it's, this is the struggle. I mean, this book is a community struggle about love and for love. So I would say, I'm going to say a couple of things. So when I was in seminary and some of the folks I was with, this is in New York, they went on to form nonprofits, you know, which are problematic, but they still do good things, as you point out. In, you know, New York City, for women and children and men who are battered in families, but mostly it's women and children who are fragile. And then it became this point of analysis, like, whatever you need to do to keep somebody from beating you to death or beating your kids to death is what you need to do. And this is among, you know, women, and they were like, that's not violence. You can name it whatever. It's love. I love myself enough to that I'm going to stay, and my kids are going to stay. And we also know that some women also inflict violence on children, right? So what children need to do, what people need to do, right? And that becomes complicated because we don't like to talk about violence, because for centuries we've been disciplined if we engage in any form of self-defense. Like, white people can walk around like strapped with everything and camouflage, right? And I'm from Texas, so I see, okay, like the gunshot in the back of the pickup truck in the rack and stuff like that, Confederate flag decal. But if you have a Panther decal or something, like, police are gonna stop you. And even when you, Philando, right? Is that the name of the brother?
Philando Castile.
Yeah, even if you say, here's my partner, my female partner next to me, the baby's in the back, I'm going to show you my permit, they still shoot you in the car with the child and the partner. So it's irrational. The levels of violence against us is rational. What we do to preserve ourselves is what we do to preserve ourselves. It's like Boots Riley says in Guillotine, like in that clip, the video clip, when the sister sings, "We were in a war before we fought one. We didn't start this." You know, war on the continent, war on the water, foreign land. Now we're Black, Indigenous, and some other continent. Now, you know, you're going to try to work us to death, rape us. So you grow us as a crop. We didn't start this. We're just trying to get out of it.
Right. And that's something that we should definitely keep in mind. I think there's a thin line to seeing modernism, you know, versus survival, you know. I mean, I guess we admire those who sacrifice their lives, you know, for us, but sometimes we get it twisted and think that this sacrifice was to be noble versus you just got killed in the battlefield. There's a difference. You know what I'm saying? Like, trying to get free, and I'm actually trying to live, you know, to see another day. And, you know, and so the Malcolms and the Martins, they pass and they become martyrs. But there's this thing, sometimes we romanticize that versus kind of understanding, like, Malcolm didn't want to die, neither did King, and I don't think they, either one, were reckless in their actions, if that's making sense. But we're made to believe that somehow they walked off the plank head up high and say, I will give my life for a better tomorrow, which...
Like a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
No, I mean, look, in different ways, under these conditions of capitalism, imperialism, anti-blackness, filicide, the hatred of children, femicide, the hatred of women, you know, the shackling and the torture of black men, we all die in different ways on a daily thing, right? It's just like how you keep your dignity, your honor. It's not always about the physical body, also your psyche. There's in a chapter with two black and the Black Myths podcast, you know, because they debunk myths or they try to critique some confusion around things. So the title of that podcast was like Angela Davis was a Panther. But we have this discussion about ancestors and the difference between being pragmatic and revolutionary. And my position is the ancestors could have had a longer life, right? Malcolm could have taken the money. King could have had a little small church or a mega church or whatever, but it was their love that made them be devoted and to be reliable with the message. And because of that, they had shortened lives. But now we have ancestors, people who love us, including people. I mean, I'll just go with the parent thing. It's not just we sacrifice our time for people who don't have resources. They take the second job or third job to feed their kids, or they go into dangerous underground economies to feed their kids, right? Mm-hmm. To keep them sheltered, you know, so they risk their dignity because now I'm going to have to be a sex worker in order to feed the twins. So we die in different ways until we change this, quote, democracy. But if we hadn't sacrificed, we wouldn't have ancestors, and we wouldn't know that people loved us enough to be steady and to be devoted.
Right. The ultimate personification of revolutionary love, would it be our political prisoners? 30, 40, 50 years in prison. And you sit there and go, you know, I think about that sometimes, and it's like they obviously had love for us to fight. Do we have love for them to care that they've been away for 30, 40, 50 years? We talked about that when we were doing the celebration for Mimir. Like, you know, guys been in there 41 years. Do we really remember that? Because there's so many people that take the gestures around fighting for political prisoners and they adapt it for things that are less than noble, maybe is the word I'm looking for, or, you know, or the opportunist. They'll use Mimir rhetoric. But then they're not giving back into the kitty to really, like, I got my cousin out, but what about Mumia, so to speak?
I think that's spot on, but I think that's the challenge. I think that we're afraid to commit publicly to political prisoners until they become, quote, non-threatening. And then by the time, like, they're in their 70s and their 80s, right? But yeah, I mean, Jalil Alamin, Kamal Siddiqui, Leonard Peltier, Mumia Rushel-McGee, Joy Powell. There's a whole list of people who a number of them have been framed, right? So even if you weren't in line with the politics, you should be principled about you can't let the state just brand you with crimes and then give you a living death sentence.
Right.
Like even Geronimo Pratt, right, did 27 years because the FBI and the LAPD framed him. And then he gets this monetary settlement. But I'll tell you, this is the way I see it. For some of us, I'll just call us the petty bourgeoisie, whatever. We want those political prisoners that have this like nice look to them. Because when I'm talking to a historian who's prominent and I say, well, Geronimo did as many years, you know, as a leader in the Southern, you know, in the Los Angeles chapter of the Panthers, and then went underground for the BLA because the cops were killing people with the FBI's, you know, engineering stuff. If Geronimo did 27 years and Nelson Mandela did 27 years, then they both were, devoted. And it's like, no, you can't compare the two because Mandela is a statesman and he's a lawyer and he's attorney and so, you know. So I'm like, no, you can't, you don't get to choose between Rushel-McGee and Angela Davis. If you're going to support Angela on any metric, you have to support Rushel-McGee because that was co-defendant. And he's the one that, you know, with John Jackson, McLean, and William Christmas, this is the reason Davis is known around the world, because they made that Revolutionary Act where it was just trying to do a hostage exchange to keep people alive. It was the prison guards who shot into the van on August 7, 1970, and killed the white judge and the teen and the two black men and injured everybody else. So we have to acknowledge the people who acknowledged us and who sacrificed, you know, their lives in the so-called free world or in the ancestral zone, just simply lost their lives because they had a vision that we should not always be hunted as a people.
That's the voice of Professor Joy James talking about the concepts in her book, In Pursuit of Revolutionary Love, Precarity, Power, and Community. As we wrap up, briefly tell us about the other two parts, power and structure. And I think you touched a little bit on communities and conflict and care. That's kind of been a lot of where our conversation has been about this afternoon, wrestling with these contradictions and concepts. But, you know, let us know about these other two parts and what, if people pick up this book, you absolutely want them to read.
I mean, you know, I like all the chapters, but some are my favorite. One with Rebecca M. Wilcox, which is on theology and religion, because they're a doctoral student at Princeton Seminary. They're also an activist who came out of one of the HBCUs in Atlanta, right? Mm-hmm. And their politics are really clear, and they tell me I'm not radical enough. I'm like, okay, I'll meditate on it. Another one that we end up with is Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. Mm-hmm. Which that was a long interview, and it followed like a blog piece I did, Airbrushing Revolution for the Sake of Abolition. And my argument was the academy and abolition had kind of eclipsed revolutionary struggle, and we're now a proxy for it. Where in the academy, we're not trained or paid to be revolutionaries. We comply, right? So it didn't even make sense logically, but I went through that. And they had some critiques of it, so we talked about it. But there's this one thing I want to read as we close. The conclusion, I call it the agape of peaches. And agape is considered by theologians to be the highest form of love, because it's not about personal family. It's not about emotion. It's not about your love partner or your sexual partner. It is about your devotion shaped by political will. So I'm going to read the agape. I call it the agape of peaches, the conclusion or concluding chapter. Read this short letter. Open letter to my mom and dad from Peaches, political prisoner. Mom, Dad, I'm communicating this way to you because it would take too much time and emotion on my part to do so through glass windows and earphones. Mom and Dad, you both have always wanted me to be someone you, others, and most of all myself, can look up to and respect. All my life, I've been taught that people were people. All my life, you've told me that no matter what I was or how I was, be the best. Mom and Dad, I am a Panther. I'm a revolutionary woman. I'm willing to fight and die for the rights of myself, my people, and all oppressed people in general. What greater pride can one have? How much dignity can one feel? How much respect can one receive if he or she takes the initiative to go after and fight for a goal? Mom and Dad, I love you both for striving and working and sweating so that I may have the things that I needed. I love you both for what you've taught me. Sure, I could go out and hold any job I desire, have all the luxuries in life, get set, and die of, quote, natural death. But to me, there is more life than that. There are the people who need to be helped and loved, not stepped on, used, and misled as we have been for so long. I've found what I've wanted out of life. I didn't find it in the streets or through dope or through luxuries. I found what I wanted through the Black Panther Party, and that is to, quote, love and serve the people, end quote. Please, Mom and Dad, I love you for what you are and what you do. Can't you love me for what I am and what I want to do? Love, your only child, Peaches. So for me, that sums up our past, our present, and our future.
We're going to end on that note. The name of the book, In Pursuit of Revolutionary Love, Precarity, Power, and Community. It is edited and authored by Professor Joy James, but there's a bunch of people whose voices are riveting throughout the pages of this book. And you give us a lot to wrestle with, a lot to think about. So we want to thank you for joining us. How can people get a hold of you?
jjames@williams.edu. And I have a PDF of Transcending the Town to Tenth, if anybody's interested in like how that book came about and what it's attempting to do. We are our own leaders and not elites. They don't have the capacity to lead. So I appreciate you being one of those leaders.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And your wonderful questions that have made me think more deeply.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else you just imitate. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Davey D. Yeah, right. Feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though.
Whoop, whoop. Yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from The Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
What's up? This is Hwapile, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
I'm Eddie Zane.
And I'm Helen Zia.
And we are on Hard Knock Radio.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip hop. Stay tuned.
I want you to get to
Portland.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What's this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It feels very hipster.
I